I'd like to thank all that have come tonight. We appreciate it again. In fact, I say that I really genuinely do. I'll tell you very honestly, I came down here and it's the first time I've ever gone anywhere and had a series of ministry meetings, and came with great fear, to say the very least. I've never done such a thing in the past, and I still enjoy gospel meetings better, but I've appreciated being here and appreciated getting to know you, and I just want you to know that genuinely, honestly, I've appreciated being with you. Could we read, please, in Philippians chapter 4 and verse number 3? I don't think that anything has ever been accomplished single-handedly. Nobody could ever say that they have any work that's been done or any work that's been accomplished for God. Nobody could really say that, you know, that's been my work. It's always been a group of individuals involved. Maybe someone kind of got the ball rolling, but others stepped in to help and encourage. And so I read this verse here because I'm planning to speak about the little bit that we saw in Russia, but I want you to know there was many others that helped and encouraged and in many ways helped us, or we never would have got to that country. Verse 3, and I entreat thee also, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and with other my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life. And I've been asking myself, why is it that there's such a thing in the Bible as a meeting? In fact, it's a very scriptural meeting. You'll read of time when the Apostle Paul came back and he gave a report of the work that he had sought to do and tried to do, and that's what we'd like to do tonight, to try and tell you a little bit about what we saw, or what I saw, in the country of Russia, or more particularly in Siberia, because Russia is such a vast country. It is beyond comprehension how big the country is. Mind you, I've never traveled across Canada. This is the farthest I've ever been west. And I've never traveled across this country. And they say you go out in the prairies and you think you're never going to get to the other end. But we did travel by train for 38 hours across Russia. And we just went 2,000 kilometers, such a short distance. And mind you, the train stopped a lot and went around, and yet it only made 3 and 4 minute stops, and travel across that country. And the farther it went, the more you begin to realize how tremendously vast the country is. It's incredible. The land it covers, I believe it's the largest country in the world as far as land mass is concerned. It's a big country. But I didn't come down here tonight to kind of just to simply tell you we gave out 53,000 Bibles. I hope that the purpose of a meeting, when you try and tell of what God has done in other countries, is that there might be in the hearts of some that are gathered here, and those that hear, there might be something stir within your soul that even some little boys or girls here might in their mind, put in their mind that maybe someday I would like to, by the help of God, go and do something somewhere, if not in your own backyard, somewhere else. And I can recall times sitting in a meeting when missionaries came and they spoke. And somehow, I don't know if it was excitement or what it was. And yet when they spoke, I thought to myself, my, that'd be something to try to do that someday. And I never really thought I would, but kind of in the back of my mind, it always was kind of there that I'd just kind of like to do something someday. So hopefully tonight it's not just a matter of kind of like a, you know, a travel agency putting a bunch of stickers on a suitcase and a little few tags and giving the brochure that tells of exotic places and kind of patting you on the back and sending you off with your bag off in the wild blue yonder. No, that's not the purpose, but I hope that in some little way maybe somebody will be stirred in their heart and mind that maybe that you would like to go, and whether there to Russia or anywhere, but maybe that you as well would like to go, or maybe you would be more exercised to help those who are trying to go and others that have gone, because there's a tremendous need. There's one thing I'm thankful for. I am more thankful for it as the years go by. It's for every single individual. I don't care who he is. I don't care where he gathers. I don't care what religious background he is. But every single person that carries the gospel into countries far away or close at home, I don't care who they are. Thank God for them all. And I pray for them. And maybe we would be encouraged to pray for it as well. When we arrived in Russia, we came into that city of Moscow on a weekend, or was on the first of the week, actually, but just after a weekend when 25,000 Jehovah Witnesses had just finished a great big convention in the same Coliseum where Billy Graham preached the gospel for a couple of weeks. And I heard a couple of the messages that Billy Graham preached, and I listened to them, and I was impressed, very impressed, and the message that he gave those people. And here, 25,000 Jehovah Witnesses from every country in the world, and they're all gathered there as kind of a springboard to reach out into that country, and thousands of them were going out into the country, and we just seemed like a few kids playing games beside the tremendous input that cult was pouring into that country. And here we are, and we have the truth, and I'll tell you something. When we started off in that country, it felt so weak and so unable to meet the need. And yet the devil has got his envoys there before we ever arrived. And he is working night and day, 24 hours a day, to a people who are open-minded, with an interest, and they're prepared to sit down and listen. And they'll sit down and listen to everybody and anybody. And they don't know the truth. They don't know the right hand from their left hand. And I don't know what gains the Jehovah Witnesses are making. In fact, in the area where we went, we never met one single person in the several hundreds of kilometers that we traveled in an area of maybe 300 or 400 square mile area that we went. And we never saw any other religious group of any kind. And we never met anyone who told us that they had ever met a foreign person that set foot in their villages. Never. In fact, many times they said, "What brought you here?" You see, the other brethren that had gone before we went, they had gone to Tumen and to Tobolsk and to Moscow and different areas like that, and I'm thankful they did. But somehow or another, I've never liked to work in the cities anyhow. And when I was going over there, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to go to the country. I like the country. And I'm thankful I went to the country. And in that country, there's a poverty that is unbelievable. You can't imagine the tremendous poverty. About a couple of years before ever we went, I started thinking about it, mulling it over in my mind. I suppose one reason I thought of going was because we'd spent a couple of years in the West Indies. My one daughter had spent several months in Zambia, and I'll tell you something, it has made an impression on Lisa's life. I would encourage, in fact, I see what the Mormons do when we were in the West Indies. The Mormons, every young person has a 2-year, what they call, missionary endeavor. And they send them to these far-off countries. And they take and they broadcast their beliefs and their doctrines. And I've often thought, wouldn't it be a great thing amongst the Lord's people if we did the very same thing with all our young people, and we got behind them, and we encouraged them to go and spend a year or two, because Lisa's come home. I'm going to say this for every young girl that maybe would consider to go, whether Zambia or anywhere else. It has made an impression upon her life that I have seen a difference in that girl ever since she set foot back on. And you know what she often says? I don't know, she says, I don't know how it can be. She says, when I was in Zambia, I thought to myself, I'll never be the same. When you see such tremendous poverty and people with nothing and people in such desperate straits and such a desperate plight. And she said, when I was over there, I wondered, how will I ever come home and be the same? And here she says, I come back home, I get into my little groove, and I head down my little toboggan, down my little road, and I'm the very same way as I ever was before, it seems. And yet I can still see a difference in her. Young person or older one, but young person, if you have an opportunity, and if you have a thought in your mind, you begin to put it into practice, in effect, and try and go, because there's tremendous opportunity. And the one reason I really wanted to go was Lisa had been over there, and the youngest daughter, Zanya, I talked of taking Jeffrey before he ever died. And I was more determined than ever that after the Lord took Jeffrey to heaven, that I was going to try and be sure if God opened up the way to take Zanya. She was just finishing high school and entering into university, and I thought, why wouldn't it be grand, great, wonderful thing if an impression could be made upon her while she's young? And before she sets her sails, as it were, for this world, because there's so much to attract, and if only I could go with her. We spend so little time with our family. We spend so much time with everybody else growing up. And the children grow up, and we spend so little time with them. And the years roll their course so quickly. And you look at the little kids that Just a few, it just seems months ago that they were pulling the pots out of the cupboard and slobbering all over the pots and pans, and you were tripping over them. And here, just a few months goes by, and it just seems now they're almost out of your grasp, and they're setting sail out into the world, and they're going. And I thought to myself, I'd just like to take and spend time with her. And I want to say this. It was the happiest 6 weeks that I have spent with my daughter in all the time that she was ever in her whole life. We've had some holidays that we've very much enjoyed as a family. We've had some times when I look back and I'm thankful for them. We all have as families. But I regret that we weren't all there. That I could have worked with all the family, but the way wasn't open to do that. But my wife was as well behind the fact to look, take Zanya and just work with her and spend time with her and try and just see what could be accomplished and what could be done. So we hit it over there and got to Moscow and took a little bit of tour around the city for several hours and looked around and saw the big Colosseum where the Jehovah Witnesses had just left and where Billy Graham preached the gospel. And then we left Moscow, and I remember coming into the airport in Moscow, and I tell you, it's a strange thing. You come into the airport, and funny how your thinking changes. We got to the airport, and we step off the plane. We walked through and made the mistake of not using the facilities on the aircraft before we got off, and we thought, well, you know, international airport, we go down and use the washroom. Let me tell you something. It had to be the most filthy sight you ever saw. At least we thought at the time it was desperate. Not even toilet paper in the place. And mess and filth and urine and everything else all over the floor. And I thought, dear me, isn't this incredible? I mean, this is bad, but it had toilets anyway. And no toilet seats. I'm getting kind of graphic maybe, but I just want you to understand the conditions in which people live in that country. And we got in the washroom and I said to the girls, wow, this is unbelievable. You know, the funny thing was, 6 weeks later coming back, wanted to use the washroom. We waited. Moscow Airport washroom really wasn't that bad. We waited to get there because, boy, tell you, nothing else compared with the Moscow Airport washroom facilities. They were really not too bad because when we got out into the country, that's where you saw the most incredible sights you ever saw, and the public uses it. Now, that's enough of that. Change directions. We went from Moscow and traveled across and got to the airport, another plane. It was daylight at 12:30 at night. It was just getting kind of quite dark because it's a long way north. And we got on this plane. The moment you stepped on the plane, now they did tell us that the planes and the trains that travel to the country are a lot worse than what traveled between Moscow and St. Leningrad and those different cities like that where the tourists go. And maybe I'll say this before I forget. Moscow is, Russia is a country that is open, they told us. But when we got there, we found that Russia is really not all that open. In fact, we had to have an invitation from the mayor of the city, which you're going to visit. You can't just simply buy a ticket and take and decide we're going to fly to this town of Yeluturis a couple thousand kilometers away. It's not just a matter that you can do that. In fact, you cannot do that. You have to get an invitation, and then you have to put the invitation in with to get your visa. And you get your business visa, and the visa tells you where you can go. And when we travel around a little distance, the one interpreter that we had that came from Tobolsk, he went with us to several towns some distance away, and he was very nervous in case he would get stopped by the police and arrested because his passport that he has to have within the country did not give him permission to travel that place. So people are not simply free like this country to pick up and jump on the next train and head off anywhere they want to go. They're not free at all. They have to get permission to move about. But anyway, we got on that plane. Well, we stepped on. The moment you step in the door, the stench from the washroom just will knock your head off. It was unbelievable. And we got on with our luggage. Well, they put the luggage on in the bottom of the plane, although we lost out of all of us going there. There was six of us, and we had 13 pieces of luggage, and we got there and we had three. And the other, we lost 10 pieces, and the other 8 pieces showed up about 4 days before we left. So we did get back most of it except for one piece of luggage. And so the girls weren't bad off because it was their suitcases. And I was thankful because I don't mind wearing the same shirt every day and washing it at night and hanging up and drying. But the girls don't somehow appreciate that. But we stepped in this plane. And, boy, got on walking on there. The carpet was ripped and in shreds all over the floor. Some of the seats were laying back flat, and some of them were upright, and some were ahead. We sat down, and there was no flight attendant to tell you anything. We sat down the seat, and you had to look all around to find your seatbelt. They were down underneath the seat. Nobody bothered. And most of the folks just looked for the ones where the seat was laid right straight back, and they just simply laid down, and the plane was about a third full, and they just simply laid down, and they promptly went to sleep, hanging onto their hand luggage, because you lay it to one side, and you'll find that somebody will steal it on you. There was no baggage doors over the, well, there was some. Some of them fell open. Some of them would close. A few of them would close. Most of them had nothing to put your luggage up in the luggage rack, you know. And in fact, when we were sitting there on the runway, we picked up a piece of the carpet, and we can see the baggage right down in the compartment underneath. And this was a four-engine jet. It looked like a DC-8. I don't know what kind it was. And anyway, that plane, after a few minutes, everybody's on, and the pilot came up the stairs. I presume it was a pilot. And another fellow with them, and they simply closed the door, cranked the thing shut. They walked up to the cockpit, shut the door, started the engines up, turned her and hit her out in the runway, and nobody said, aye, bye, take your leave or nothing. They just took off. And we flew for 4 hours to Tu Minh, and nobody said anything about coming into land, or nobody said nothing of the sort. Simply three bells went boing, boing, boing. Nobody did anything. There was no coffee offered. There was no nothing. And after the thing landed, he taxied up to a spot, and it was all dark in Tu Minh because it was about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was quite dark, although it wasn't perfectly 100% dark, because even the whole night it never got real, real dark, and it got daylight around 4:30, 5 o'clock. And so after the thing was stopped for 3 or 4 minutes, we're sitting there. Some of the people were still sleeping, and we didn't know exactly what to do, and finally the door opened, and the captain and his buddy walked out, and they walked down, they flipped the door open, and they shoved it up, and there was a stairway there, and they walked out. Nobody said goodbye or anything. So after a minute or two, we thought, well, let's get off. So we walked up, and we walked down the stairs. There was no terminal. There was nothing. And we could see in the distance a building with lights. That was the only thing we could see, and a bunch of other aircraft parking around, and nobody around. Nobody. That we're in Tu Minh, and so we walked about a quarter of a mile to the terminal, and we got in the terminal, and I tell you, it was good to find Jesse Fitch there, and we spent a couple hours with him. He took us to a place, and then we hired an interpreter that was going to go with us, and we got on a bus with the luggage that we did have that finally came off the plane, and after searching around, they said that they would try and get the other luggage there, and it didn't seem too hopeful. I thought the situation was bad in the Caribbean. Let me tell you something, it's nothing like Russia. Nobody in Russia cares less. They all get their 18 to 20 rubles a month, whether they work or whether they don't. So why bother? Things are just as well not to work. You get paid anyway, so don't worry about it. You go into a... Well, I'll tell you that later. You know, we got on a bus, and the thing started hitting up the road, and over a road that was so full of potholes, and we thought the bus was pretty bad, but actually it wasn't bad because we got on a lot of buses that were an awful lot worse. We headed up this road through the country, out of Tu Minh, a city of 600,000 people, and we were going about a 2 or 3 hour bus ride to the town of Yeluturusk. The interpreter had never been there before, we had never been there before, and we didn't know where we were staying. And let me tell you, in those towns of 35,000 people or 45,000 people, there's no such thing as a motel or a hotel, nothing like that at all. We were simply going, looking, and we were praying going down the road that, Lord, we might get some spot to stay, because we didn't know where we were going to stay. We didn't know a soul, and the interpreter had never been there before either. So we're heading up the road, and finally, going through that country. What a country. You just go for hour after hour, literally through the country, and you don't see so much as a building. You don't see a fence. You do see trees. It's kind of like the prairies. It was flat. At least where we were in Siberia, it was just as flat as what it is driving up here towards Winnipeg. Very flat. And you see bush in the distance, kind of like the prairies here. The same as, in fact, when I was driving up towards Winnipeg from the south, coming up from the States, it just reminded me of Russia, with one exception. You see absolutely no buildings. You don't even see a shed. You don't see a hydro pole. Although once in a while you see a big line of power lines running through, but you don't see anything. And then all of a sudden you'll come in the distance, you'll see a village. And that village is connected with a State Farm. Every time they have a village of 300 or 400 houses, there's a large State Farm there covering possibly 20 or 30,000 acres, milking 2 or 3,000 cows, or beef or whatever it might be, or chickens. And so you'll drive for literally 7, 8 miles, and you'll see absolutely nothing. You'll see wagons and combines out in the field. And some of the equipment didn't look that bad. They were growing corn. When we left home, the corn was about this high. When we got to Russia, the corn was about this high. And by the time we left, after 6 weeks, it had got up a little higher. But the corn looked like the corn in Egypt's day when Pharaoh saw the corn blasted by the east wind. It looked pretty sad. It wasn't a very healthy-looking crop. But nobody cares. Nobody worries. Maybe they worry. I shouldn't say they don't worry, because people do worry. But nobody cares. And there's a veterinarian that lives down near us, and I visit him occasionally. He's a Christian. And he goes over there to try and help. He's been over there a number of times to try and help on the farms. But he said it's almost impossible to turn people's attitudes around. It's not because people are careless altogether, but there's no incentive. Absolutely none. So we got into Ilutrusk, and we started to drive around the streets and in this old bus, and finally we came to the bus stop, and we got off. There's no such thing in that country of hiring a taxi, although there was taxis in the city. In the country, there was no such thing. You looked around, and the interpreter was somewhat familiar with it, and he looked around, and he saw trucks, and he would go over and try and get the man in the truck. And finally, he was able to hire a truck. We hired trucks and old buses that we hired for $7 a day, U.S. dollars, which is 7,000 rubles a day, and they paid the fuel. And they would drive us 30, 40, 50, 60 kilometers delivering Bibles to these villages. And every time I would pay the man at least twice as much as he asked, and it would always pay his gas because I felt desperately sorry for them, although gas, I think, was around 7 cents or 8 cents a gallon, so it's dirt cheap. But nevertheless, we finally got an old truck, and we drove around a few streets looking for some place we could stay. And finally, some people were telling them, the interpreter, that there's this health clinic, and they could maybe get beds in the health clinic. We got there, and we were very happy to find a place where we could stay. And we rented rooms, myself and another brother. We stayed in one room. We rented another room, got another room for the interpreter, and two interpreters, because we hired another interpreter in the town. And then we got a room for the three girls who were with us, my daughter Zania and Heidi and Emily McCandless from St. Thomas, two teenagers, and Jerry Adams, a brother who was saved a couple years ago in Burgessville. He is about 27 or 28 years old and has 5 children that he left home and went with us. And as well, Bill Burton, who was gathered in the assembly through the Via Magazine outreach. So we looked around, and so we got these rooms. And we were very thankful to get them, because it was getting late in the day by the time we got them. And in the deal with the rooms, we paid $5 each for the room, including meals. And for the 6 weeks we were there, we had potatoes 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night. And we had cucumbers and tomatoes, and that is basically all we had. And that wouldn't be so bad, because I like potatoes, but they mixed it with grease and kind of an oil. It actually was something like 10W30. And it was very thick stuff, and you literally picked your plate up, and we would ask for an empty plate, and we would pour the grease off the plate, and you would just ask that people could, I like our potatoes with no oil, but they didn't seem to have any clue of how to cook without this grease and oil running all over the place. And a few times they gave us something that looked like hamburger, and you weren't quite sure where it was, but I always thought of 1 Corinthians 10, ask no questions for conscience sake, and you simply took and squeezed it, and you squeezed the grease out of it, and it would drip down, and then you would eat. We never saw a banana. We never saw oranges. We saw some apples that were for sale that my wife would hardly have spent enough money to try and make applesauce out of them. The people live in absolute poverty. The average wage in the country there was about 18 to 20 rubles a month. That's 18 to 20 U.S. dollars a month. And tomatoes at the market cost 2,000 rubles or $2 for a kilogram. And they are making $20 a month, and they can buy a kilogram of tomatoes for 2,000 rubles or $2. Sad, sorry situation. The thing that impressed me, you know, one thing about kids, it doesn't take very long to get kids to laugh. But I can tell you this, where we stayed in this health center, so-called. People are very superstitious there. And I really don't think they were that sick, but they seemed to go there for depression. They had mud baths and heat things, and they had all kinds of things that people had, and they were very superstitious. We were told by the interpreter, he said, now, in the country, things are much more superstitious than the city. We couldn't, if I stood on this side of the door, and you were on that side of the door, you would never talk through the doorway. It's a custom, and they warned us very carefully about it, and I made a mistake a few times, and the people were tremendously horrified that I would speak through a door. And different things like that. And in this health center, so-called, there was a lot of kids there with their parents, or with mainly with mothers. Divorce rate is tremendously high. They say that it's far greater than in North America. And there was many single mothers there with their children. And we would try and get those kids to laugh. And it was almost impossible to get a little boy or girl that 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age to laugh. They literally didn't laugh. The older people rarely smiled. And they always talked about the future. And they're afraid. And they would tell us they were afraid. Yet when we did travel into Tumin, city of 600,000 people, I did see things were somewhat different. And people seemed to have more hope in there. And people had seemed to have more interest in Tumin than they did in the country. But they're wide open for the Word of God. And so we arrived there with our old bus, well, on the bus, and then we hired this old Polish bus that we used quite a bit. Some days we would try and hire two or three, but other days you just couldn't find them. They're just not available. It's not like around here. Around here, if you got the bucks, it'll get you anything, basically anything. You can always get something to rent. There you cannot. People will just park the thing. They don't care. And they're just not going to rent it to you. It's literally, mind you, in the village of 35,000 people, there was not that many vehicles. But they are just not available. Either they're broken down or whatever. And so we did get this old Polish yellow van. It was, I tell you something, been around for a long time. And we got that thing, we hit it up to Tumin where the Bibles had been shipped, and we took about four trips and we brought 53,000 Bibles down from the warehouse and we stored them in the health center. They gave us an area to store these Bibles. And I'll tell you something, the little kids that are this age, they were a tremendous help. We would give them a pencil from Canada and maybe a little tag to put on your jacket with a Canadian flag, and they would carry Bibles, boxes of Bibles, 14 Bibles in a box, and they would carry them from that old beater into that room, quite a distance of maybe 125 feet and up a flight of stairs, and they would just carry those boxes for endless amount of time, and then we were taking them back out. The kids were just too happy to help us carry them. I love those kids. And spend a lot of time with the kids. Try to teach them Jesus loves me in English. We started gospel meetings in the health center from the first night we were there, the second night we were there. And people came. In the health center, there was about 125 people staying there. And every night, there was 150 people there. That the nurses or those that were there, the doctor and the accountant and those that worked in the place, they came, and people from the community came. But there was three of us men, myself and Jerry Adams and Bill Burton. So we ran around again and we left Jerry there. He had been saved not too long and he hadn't been doing a great amount of speaking, but he said, I think I can handle it right here. I'm getting to know the people. So I went off and rented a library for myself on the other side of town and started gospel meetings there. And Bill and I started there, and after three or four days, we met some people from another town about 10 miles away, and they said, would you come to our town and have some meetings? So Bill Burton went off to that town. Where I was, about 70 people came the first night, and the numbers dwindled down to about 35 or 40. And where Bill went to the other town, he started meetings there, and it started off with about 70, and by the time he left, he went home before I did. There was 270 there the last night, and about 40 people professed to be saved in that place and where I was and where Jerry Adams was. And so the people came with tremendous interest. And we tried to simply give out Bibles here and there throughout the day and simply tried to talk to people from morning to night. We had breakfast every morning at 7:30. The people were very prompt. Lunch at 12 o'clock, supper at 5. And we were there for each meal and insisted that everybody got out of bed at 7:30, and the girls included were down there at 7:30 for breakfast. And at about 8:15, we went out every day. And there wasn't a night, I don't think, in the 6 weeks that I was there, almost 6 weeks that I was there, we rarely got to bed before 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning because the people came. And I can tell you this, I was absolutely zapped when I got home. In fact, when I got back home, they asked me to speak. And so the brethren had told us, Jesse Adams and Brother Malcolm, I spoke to Malcolm, and he said, you know, when you get to the town, you just have to make appointments to go to these factories, and they'll actually let you come in and preach the gospel in these factories and give Bibles out in factories and offices and stores and you name it. Doesn't matter where. Well, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of impatient. We start off trying to make appointments, and then you'd have to try and find a place. Finally said the bus driver, forget about it. Look, just forget it. Start up the street, and every place you see, stop. And we had a girl hired as an interpreter for the girls, and we had two men hired and also another man, so sometimes we had four interpreters with us, with the five of us, because there was so much personal conversation, you just hated to be without an interpreter standing right beside you. And so we simply drove up the street and come to a stop, a store, you stopped. There'd be people in there, we'd get out with our Bibles under our arms, and mind you, we tried to rent 3 buses a day so that everyone could go a different direction, and 2 or 3 of us on a bus with the interpreter and a couple of us. Usually one of the girls would come with me, and quite often Zanya came with myself, with me, and sometimes she would go with Jerry or Bill, or sometimes we'd be all together if we couldn't get enough vehicles. But you come into a shop, and everybody come to a dead stop. You come into a factory, and with almost without exception, the manager would simply shut the entire factory down, and he would call all the people together, and we would give out Bibles. And then they'd tell us what you're doing. What are these Bibles about? What is this all about? We've heard of the Bible before. We've heard of God. What is it all about? And many times in the factory, I would usually take and preach the gospel, and then whoever was with me, it was usually Zanya or Heidi or Emily went with me, and say, you know, Emily, this girl's going to tell you how she was saved. And you know, Zanya tells me she told how she was saved probably 300 times to groups of people as we gathered in these places. I thought of the Apostle Paul in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 3, those women that labored with him in the gospel. And I can tell you something, our girls tremendously enjoyed it. Far more than once, I saw those girls sit down and weep after people had hugged them and kissed them and thanked them for coming and telling them and giving them Bibles, and old, especially old babushkas, old grandmothers, they would simply come up to us, and I couldn't tell you how many times they put their hands around you and they would hug you and they would kiss you on each cheek, and then they would just thank you for bringing a Bible to them. After we were there just a few days, the mayor of the town came. He had been the one that had sent the invitation, and it had been arranged through a brother, that long story of a connection that he had met her, and she had sent the invitation. So she came to see us, and she said, now, in a day or so, we're having the 211th birthday of the town, and she said, would you come down and speak to the town and tell us what you're doing? She said, there'll be 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 people at the park, and she said, would you come? And there's going to be folk dancers and all kinds of interesting Russian practices going on, you know, dancers and clowns and you name it. They're all there, from kids to old people, performing. So I said, sure, I'd be glad to, very happy to. So we took 4,000 Bibles down to and piled them all up at the gate to be ready to give out when the people left. And that day, they fit me in between the clown and the folk dancers. And felt like Billy Graham, because they gave me about maybe half an hour to preach the gospel. Now that's only 15 minutes speaking with an interpreter. But I have never seen people, just literally a mass of people crowded right into the bottom of a grandstand that probably stood up this high, and with great big booming loudspeakers, and the people are jammed, crowded right in. It's just like a sea of people. And from the oldest to the youngest, from the children to the aged people, there was absolute dead silence. You could hear a pin drop if there was on a floor. And I believe that day God gave help as I tried to tell the people what a blessing that book had been to all that have read it. And how it tells of a Savior that came from the glories of heaven and suffered and died at Calvary and died for their sins. And how God, in grace and love and mercy, desires to see people saved. And so we were able to tell the people. After that, we went down the Vera, who walked down with her, the interpreter who lived in the town, and she taught school, so she was well known in the town, and she knew English almost flawlessly. And so after we went down, there was an old lady. She probably was about 80. And she worked herself through the crowd. And she stood waiting while all the town fathers, I guess it's like that in politics everywhere, they must have thought we were important people, I guess. I don't know. They didn't realize back home in Canada, folks wouldn't give us the time of day. But over there, they must have thought that we were quite the dignitaries or something or other. And they all crowded around to shake hands with you. And this is Dr. So-and-so, and this is the one, and that one, and so on. Fine, it was all done. But there's this old lady dressed in black. She leaned on her cane with her daughter, and she got up close, and she said, "You've got to come to my house. You've got to." We had decided that because it was at this health center, rather than going to people's houses, where it would take so much time to find it, and so much time, we just said, look, we're down there, and they had told us we could use the cafeteria or the dining room, which was a small room. We could use that any time of the day to talk to people. Just come there. So we most of the time tried to make sure that somebody was there all later in the afternoon and into the evening to talk. But she said, "You've got to come to my house." She was an old lady. She said, "I've been a Christian for many years." And when I heard that, I said, "We'll come. When do we come?" "Well, tomorrow night." I wish I had it taken all of us, but I took Zanya, and we went to that house. And we got there, I would say it'd probably be about 7 o'clock. We were there till midnight. And that lady told us a story of her life. She told, and there were, in the house there was gathered with her about 20 or 25 believers, Christians. And they were so delighted to see us there. I couldn't tell you how thankful they were to see. They talked of hearing that there was Christians in other parts of the world. But most of them had been saved just in the last 3 or 4 years. But that old lady was the one who had brought the gospel to them. And she told us what it was like to live under communism as a Christian. Mind you, she said it was difficult living under communism as anybody. It wouldn't matter who you were. But as a Christian, the desperate conditions they were in and the fear that they lived under. If someone, even whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, it didn't matter. If someone got a grievance against you, all they had to do was to call the certain police office or go to the police office and put an accusation against you that you were speaking bad about the prime minister, about the government, or something like that, and there would be no questions asked. In fact, it reminds me of what we read in the newspaper about this sexual abuse, and that a girl can just make an accusation as whether it's right or wrong, and I'm sympathizing with the girls, believe me. But at the same time, the man's arrested without any questions asked. But that's how it was in Russia, that they were arrested without a question asked, and basically oftentimes disappeared. And that woman had been a professor in a university for a number of years, and she said, "I'm one of the few professors that came all the way through, and I'm still living today." She said, hardly anybody that I know was left alive. She told us of the trucks coming, and several times that night she talked about the trucks coming. Several times that night she wept, and so did we. As she told of what it was like in 1942 when her husband was at war, and she was a young married girl. She moved back home with her parents, who lived with the grandparents, in a house with 2 rooms in it. And it was on a street in Yalutra. She said the house no longer stands. And she said that night after night, you would hear of people being taken. And she said at night is when you'd hear the trucks. And the trucks would come up the street, and you would hear them coming. And the dogs would be barking, and the soldiers would be shouting. And she said the truck would always stop. And then they would go into a house. And then weeks went by, and sometimes it was quiet for a while, and then other times the trucks would come night after night. And she said one night the trucks came, and the trucks drove up the street, and the trucks didn't stop at the neighbors. The trucks stopped outside our door. She said, "I lay in bed," she said, "so many nights when my heart just pounded out of fear." And that night, she said, "I laid in bed as my heart was just pounding," and she tapped her breast like that. And she says, "My father jumped up quickly to answer the door. And grandpa got up, and the grandmother got up, And three young soldiers pounded on the door. My father opened the door and they stepped in. It was snowing. It was bitterly cold in February of 1942. And they stepped inside the door. She said, they just seemed like children. They just seemed like boys. And they had their great coats on. They called up my grandfather's name. My grandmother, she said, scurried through the house and she got a few clothes put together into a bag. And she got a bit of food put into a bag. And she tried to kiss my grandfather goodbye. And he said, my grandfather tried to hug us. And she said, I watched, the last thing I saw was they took my grandfather out the door. And they dragged him out to the truck. And they put him in the back of a truck. And she said, I will never forget the sight as I saw my grandfather standing with others in the back of the truck on a cold wintry night. And he waved his arm at us. And she said, we never saw him again. He was put to death. Why? She said, for preaching the gospel and talking to people about the Lord Jesus Christ. And she said, we never saw him again. And the years rolled their course. And here she is, an 80-year-old woman, and God has blessed her and seen souls saved in Ada. We gathered with those Christians there on a Tuesday night one night, asked us to come, so I made a point to go and went down to the house. They had a prayer meeting. I tell you, they had a different prayer meeting than we do. They all prayed together out loud at the same time, the women and the men. And they prayed. But I'll tell you, they were a happy people, although she said, we're not nearly as happy today as we were back there in 1942. She said, God came near, and we knew God, she says. And as she spoke about it, you could see the marks on her face, the tear-stained face and the wrinkled old face of that woman. Her hands were all narrowed from working so hard over the years. But oh, she said, we were happy because God himself came near. And she said, we knew God in those days like we don't know him today. And finally, at midnight, Zani and I left that house. And we walked about a mile and a half because he did a lot of walking. We probably walked 10 miles, 15 miles a day easily. And we walked about a mile and a half or 2 miles back to where we were staying. And Zania said, walking along the street, I don't think I'll ever forget what that woman has told us. You know what? I regret it that we didn't have it on tape because the interpreter was there with us and she interpreted it all. We would ask questions and she would answer them. I regret that we didn't have it on tape. It was the most incredible story that woman told. But in that town, we carried on trying to preach the gospel. The Christians supported us, something tremendous. And then also up in the next town, 10 miles away with, maybe 20 miles, 15 miles away, it had 10,000 population, where Bill Burton went preaching the gospel. There was about 20 Christians up there as well, and they met every Lord's Day, both of those places, to remember the Lord. And the interesting thing was, they wouldn't let us remember the Lord with them. And I was impressed. And they said that there has to be there's a pastor that kind of moves amongst them, and he would have to interview us first to see if we were suitable. They had a rule that no one could just sit down with him and remember the Lord. And I thought, isn't that great? Isn't that tremendous? That these people have an understanding of the Bible and the Word of God. That old lady told us that before the war and before communism, she's going back, mind you, to her grandfather's testimony, that there were many, many assemblies, hundreds of them, scattered throughout the country of Russia. She said there were many, and she spoke of assemblies that gathered. She didn't mention gathering in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. She simply spoke of Christians gathered together, and they remembered the Lord. She says, from as young as she can recall, she can't recall a Sunday, unless because of tremendous opposition, they couldn't meet. They didn't meet the same place two Sundays in a row. They would meet in a bush or in a barn under a haystack. They had most amazing place they met, she said, devised to meet. And many times they would lose touch and then get back in touch. But she said, people always remembered the Lord every Lord's Day. I thought, isn't that amazing? And here we feel that Russia has been a country without a testimony in that country. And here's a woman that bears testimony of the fact that it's just not true. Now, mind you, there was still a tremendous lack of people that had a Bible and so on. However, one day I was at the market. The girls had gone off to Min. They took a two and a half to three-hour bus ride to buy bananas. They were desperate for some bananas and chocolate bars. And so they went off to Min to get something to eat. And I was at the market and I met a girl. She walked up. I had no interpreter. They had all gone to Tumin. And this girl came up, a woman about 27, 28, and she started to speak to me in English. And I was glad because I had no interpreter. I was just given no Bibles. And she started to speak to me in English, broken English. She told me, as a girl in Moscow, in the university, the professor had told them that the Bible is a sacred book. And she said, the professor told us you all need to get one. And she said, I got one. She said, it was hard to get one, but I got one. And she said, from then until now, she's been married 7 years, from then till now, in their village, 10 miles away, hers is the only Bible in that entire village for all those years. And she said, in fact, people gather in our house at night, and quite often we'll have discussion and talk about the Bible. I said to her, well, what have you learned? And she told me different things she learned about God and about Jesus and about the death of Christ and how he has died for sinners. And she talked on for quite a while like that, and I tried to speak to her about a time when you have trusted Jesus as your Savior, and she didn't grasp, she had so much truth. And leaning against an old army truck, I opened up to her Russian Bible, the 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse number 18, Christ also was once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust. I couldn't read it, but she read it. She stood against that truck for 3 or 4 minutes, and quietly standing there, the tears filled her eyes and started to trickle down her cheeks. And she just said quietly, kind of quietly to me, she says, that's amazing that he suffered for me. And we talked a little longer. She said, will you come to the village where I am? Well, that Sunday I'd come on Sunday afternoon. And that Sunday there was going to be a baptism with the Christians. And they were traveling to Tumin because they don't baptize themselves. The pastor or bishop or whoever you call him up in Tumin does the baptizing. So all the Christians were getting on the bus going to Tumin. So Zanya and Heidi and Emily and the interpreters and Bill and Jerry, they wanted to go up to the baptism. And I had told the girl I would be at her place at about the early afternoon. Well, Sunday I couldn't find a taxi for anything. I couldn't find a car. There was no taxis in the town. I couldn't find anybody to drive me. I couldn't find a bus to hire. I couldn't find anything. I was thinking all morning. I'd been running around all morning trying to get somebody to drive me. I thought, I've got to get somebody. And I had no interpreter. I couldn't even speak the language. And I was trying to talk, duh, duh, and then all the rest of it. And finally I thought, I told that girl I'm going to be there, and I desperately wanted to be there. So I took, she had wrote her name down and the name of the town and a little map of the town. Once you get to the town, how to get to her house. So it was no map how to get to the town, and I had no map of the area. And I didn't even know anything except I knew a highway went by that side of the town. And so I headed out of town. It was raining. And I didn't have a raincoat or anything. And I'll tell you something, she was a mucky day. Filthy, dirty. The whole country is dirty. Everything's dirty. I headed out of the town and started hitchhiking. And the car occasionally would stop. There wasn't many cars on the road, but they would stop, and I would show them I started off with a 500 ruble note, so I soon up to 2,000 rubles and showed them the name of this town. And, finally, one man said, duh. He took the money. We head off in the country. He was a wild-looking guy driving an old beat-up ladder. And we headed off in the country. Then I started to think, boy, they say that these fellas take you out in the country and rob you. And I thought, well, Lord, I hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, we finally got on a road that was so muddy. And then I started to think, well, Lord, if this thing gets stuck, what do I do? Get out and keep walking or help the guy? And so finally we got to the town and got to that folks' house. Had a wonderful, one of the happiest times I think I've ever had visiting with a family. There was a girl that had just saved. And sitting with her husband, trying to show him, telling him, look at it, it's so simple, it's so easy. And she's the one that's interpreting between the two of us, because he couldn't speak English at all, and she had about a 50% grasp of the language, and she's trying to show him how simple it is that Christ died for his sins, but he couldn't see it. And I taught the kids, the two children, the couple of Sunday school courses, especially Jesus Loves Me in English, and the mother was delighted to learn it, and she wrote it all down so she could continue teaching it to the kids. Had never heard that beautiful song before. And that family lived in a house that had a room, and that room was no larger than that chairs up here and across the end. And they had a double bed, a couple little tiny cots for the kids, and the double bed was like about a 3/4 size of ours. And had a table and a few chairs and a sofa, an old beat-up sofa. And they had a kitchen that was attached to one side that was their kitchen, about 5 feet square, and had a fridge and an old stove in it of some sort, a gas stove of some kind, and a few cupboards. And they shared a bathroom, which I went up to use. And it was all it was a hole in the floor, like with water running through the bottom, and absolutely, unbelievably filthy and slippery. You had to watch it didn't fall in. It was terrible. And there was the situation those people lived in. And they've got two children, and the oldest one is 6 or 7 years of age, and the youngest one is about 3. And that's the poverty in which these people live. Can I take another minute and tell you, when we were at this health club, we met a lady whose name was Olga. Olga's husband had died the same month as our son Jeffrey died. He died with cancer. Suicide is a tremendous problem there. Vera, who interpreted for me, I said to her, I'd like to go to the cemetery. Her husband committed suicide in January of this year, a man about 33, 34 years of age. We went to the cemetery one day before I tell you about Olga. We went to the cemetery that day, and I stood there and took some photographs of Vera standing beside her husband's grave. People are so filled with despair. Unbelievable despair. And I have never seen a cemetery, and I thought of it today when I went out to visit Brother Ron and went out there past the large cemetery. It was a cemetery much, much, much smaller than that. But beside the stones, there were little benches built. And it was a Sunday afternoon we were there. It was a beautiful day. And we rode out in the bus. We got out and we walked through, and that cemetery was full of people. And I looked at the graves. Young men, a lot of young men. And there was women sitting on the little bench beside that grave with the children. And the mother would have her head in her hands. And old people, old ladies in black clothes sitting beside the graves. And I would look at the stones, and some of them had been dead for 15, 20, 30 years. They weren't all stones. There were wooden crosses, and there was a few stones, and some stones painted, and some ground out, and some similar to ours. And there they were, in all their sadness and their sorrow. Despair marked the people, right, left, and center. Absolute despair. And Olga, whose husband had died the same month that Jeffrey died, and my daughter Zani got very close to Olga, though they couldn't speak the language. And Olga said, "You have to come to our town. You've just got to." Well, we had made up our mind. We were just going to the towns close by, and her town was 200 or 250 miles away. A long bus trip over there, let me tell you. A long trip with a transfer in the middle of it. You had to go to Tumin and then get another bus. She said, "Our town has got 3,000 homes," and she was the postmaster. She said, "I know everybody in town." And she said, "If you will bring 3,000 Bibles, I will arrange that all the people will come to one place, and one person from every home, and they'll all get a Bible." Well, it was too good to pass up, and we had come to love Olga and talk to her, and she came to so many gospel meetings, maybe the 2 or 3 weeks that she spent in this health center. And finally she said, we said, "All right, we'll come." And we loaded, in fact, we had to call her, phone her at the post office that had a phone. And that's another story, getting the phones. In fact, and all the time I was there, I got 5 phone calls out of the country, and I had to wait 4 and 5 and 6 hours at a time to get out of the country. A 5-minute phone call to my wife, and one time for about 15 minutes, and at the end it just goes all of a sudden dead, and that's it. And you had to line up in long lineups to book your phone call for 5 days ahead of time. Anyway, we called Olga and said, "Well, Olga, we can't come this week. We'll come next week." And she said, all the people were saying to her, "Don't tell us that somebody's coming from Canada. Don't be so ridiculous, Olga." Yeah, they didn't believe her. And then she had to go and tell them, "Yeah, they're not coming this week. They're coming next week." And she said, "I'll tell you, I was sure hoping that you were going to come. I was desperate." And so the next week we took all these Bibles on our old Polish bus, and the Polish bus down to the bus station. And the bus came in. Many people on those buses, I'll tell you, they travel almost full. And we had Bibles piled, a big heap of Bibles piled. I tell you something, a pile of Bibles about that high. And the bus driver looked at us, and we said, "We want to load them on." And we had to pay him some rubles to get him, let us put them on. And if you pay enough to those bus drivers, they'll let you do anything. And we literally put them onto the places on the bus in the aisleway. We put them everywhere in the bus, and we drove all the way to Tumin in this bus. And we gave out Bibles on the bus and talked to the people all the way in the bus trip to Tumin. Then we got them all off in a very busy bus station in Tumin. And we waited another hour. And we left Yalutrisk about 4:30 or 5 or so in the morning. And then we got to Tumin. We had to unload them and wait for another bus. And we got them on. And same story. We had to pay to get them on. And finally we're off in this old beat up bus heading up the road. And you wonder, the thing is so filthy you can hardly see out the windows. Unbelievable. And the road is just as bad. And we finally, after a long trip, exhausting trip, we got to this town where Olga lived. And that afternoon, we got there maybe 1:30 in the afternoon. And at 1:30, the people started to come. They came in bikes and trucks and buses and walked and three-wheeled motor bikes with carts on the side. In fact, in the country, you hardly see any motorbike without a sidecar on it. And they came, old babushkas and everybody, and by 5 o'clock, all the Bibles were gone, 3,000 gone, except 300 we had kept to give to Olga because she was a postmaster for a couple other little villages farther out. And she said, we'll see that they're distributed. And that night in that house, people came and went, and her family traveled from a long way away to come to be there because it was such a unique thing that Canadians were actually staying in their town and able to talk to them about the Bible. And we talked till the wee hours of the morning about the Bible, maybe until 2:30 in the morning, or I don't know how late it was. And then she had not a bad apartment. She gave me her bed with her boy, and I slept in there. And the two girls, my daughters Anya and Heidi, they slept in a cot that was, I tell you, was so small, it was like a canoe, and I took a nice picture of them down in the bottom of that thing. And then the interpreter slept in kind of a kitchen, and I don't know where she slept, with her couple other children. And early in the morning we got up, and we went back to the bus station. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say there was 1,000 people at that bus station in the morning when we went to get on the bus, and they held onto our arms, and they begged us to stay. They said, there's nobody in this whole place that has religious services of any kind. Would you stay and talk to us about the Bible and tell us about God? And they pleaded with us to stay, and we said, we cannot. And we got on that bus and drove up the road, and the girls cried, and so did I, as you head up the road and you look out the back of that dirty old window and you see the people standing until we went to the corner, and they're all standing waving their arms as we headed up the road. Actually, Max McLean has gone back to the same town and visited the town back maybe about October or November of this year, about 4 months after we left, and had some great visits and a few meetings in the town. But one more thing I'll mention, and the time is way past. They've got nothing. Before I went, I had a problem with my tooth about 3 days before I went, and I went to the dentist, and he said, I think you've got a root, going to have a problem. You need a root canal done. I said, well, I'm going to Russia, and I can't get that done now. He said, no, you can't. So I said, well, he said, I'll give you some penicillin. So we got over there, and I had my penicillin. But my tooth acted up a little bit, but I didn't use it. And after I was there about 2 or 3 weeks, one of the Christians that we had met there, a young couple, their baby took sick. The hospitals, when we went into them and gave out Bibles, stunk to high heaven. Absolutely reeked. You could hardly stand it. And the old age homes were worse. It was so unbelievably unbearable. You could hardly stand the smell. And their baby took sick, and the baby went into the hospital and had pneumonia. And they told him they had it in some kind of a, looked to me like a steam, trying to put some steam onto the baby or something like that. That's all they had. They had no bacteria. They had no penicillin. They had no nothing. And I never even thought about my penicillin for about 3 days. And I went up with a couple to see their baby one day, and I'll tell you, I was shocked. That baby was dying. All of a sudden, it dawned on me, I've got penicillin back at the house. And I said, look, I've got some penicillin. I forgot all about it. And they said, well, could we have it? I said, well, I don't know anything. I'm no doctor. And I don't know how you use this stuff, but it's in white tablets. And so we went back and said, don't tell the doctor anything. You know, the doctor's over there, the same as over here. Can't get involved with the patient. But we took the white tablets and cut it up into 4 pieces and went back into the room, and we got that baby and melted the stuff down and put it in an eyedropper and got it into the baby with some kind of a sugar and stuff like that to get it into the baby without him coughing it all up. And about every hour and a half, the mother stayed there, and she gave him some more, and gave him some more. She said, I don't know if it will die or not. She said, look at it, my baby's dying anyway. So she gave him some more, and 4 days later, brought the baby home. Got a picture of them after they brought the baby home. And I'll tell you, I was thankful for an impacted tooth, or a problem with my tooth. And I'm thankful that I had the problem, because I believe I had the problem, so I could take the penicillin there, because I haven't had a problem since it came back. And you know, such poverty. You go into stores and you line up the stores at empty counters, and yet there's just so little there, and yet the people are wide open to receive the gospel. And what we need is not someone to go for a few weeks. We need folks that are young people and older ones as well that are prepared to stand up and leave home and leave the comforts of this land and go to that land and plus many others. When it came time for us to leave, the Christians there treated us so royally and so well. They got absolutely nothing, but they lined a truck up, an old truck, with a back covered in with a canvas to take us to to Min to get on the train because we'd run out of money and had no money to fly out, so we were taking the train out. We took and bought a ticket for each of us with a sleeper, they called it. It was a bed you lay down in, filthy, dirty, for $6, 6,000 rubles. Took us 2,000 kilometers across Russia for 38 hours for $6. No food, mind you, no nothing like that. You take your own stuff. But those Christians